Hi, my name is Nicholas Kühner, and I'm going to be running a series of podcasts on brand strategy and digital marketing.
If that wasn't exciting enough for you, we've got some of the best guests in the world who are going to tell us some of their wins, some of their biggest fails, and some tips and tricks they wish they knew when they started out on their journey. So if you're in marketing or sales or anything to do with communications, this is the podcast for you, and I look forward to having you join us.
Come chat with Nicholas. He'll listen to you. Then he'll laugh and then he'll cry with you. It's all in a safe space for you to speak your truth. Oh, come and chat with me.
Well, I have the one and only Jeremy Sampson joining me today. So, Jeremy, welcome and thank you for joining me in short notice.
Nicholas, always good to be with you. I can't remember how far we go back, but it's probably a decade and a half at least. And it's good to maintain the contact and see how well you're doing up in Scandinavia.
Yeah, well, it has been. I mean, I think I first joined Interbrand in 2008. So that I can't count that well on the fly. So we'll just take your word for it. It's almost two decades. And it was actually before that, because while I was at university, Interbrand Sampson was sort of the go-to brand agency in South Africa that every branding student wanted to work at. So yeah, it's been a long road. So, Jeremy, where are you at the moment?
I'm in Johannesburg. You mentioned Interbrand, and I guess from my voice, people will guess that I come originally from England and came out to South Africa. Then I was headhunted back to England and I went back and worked there for 5 years. And then I decided to come back to South Africa again. And coming back, it was also representing Interbrand, which in those days was independent. It had been started by John Murphy and he and I had become friends. So we started Interbrand Sampson in Johannesburg and grew it, in fact, to arguably the major branding design consultancy in Africa. During that time, John Murphy sold out and Omnicom bought into Interbrand, as they still do. But we ran Interbrand Sampson when you were with us, and then it became Interbrand Africa. And that's how it grew. And then I left them 7 years ago, and not in the happiest of circumstances, I'm afraid. And they shortly lost the license and closed down. Meanwhile, I had jumped ship and joined Brand Finance. Now, Brand Finance, some of you will know, David Haig, who founded it, broke away from Interbrand in about, 1997. He and I had worked together in South Africa for South African breweries, so we knew each other. We kept in loose contact over 20-odd years. And then when he heard that I was leaving Interbrand, he said, we're finally going to work together. So I've been with Brand Finance now for 7 years, chairman of Brand Finance Africa. And in the 7 years, we've grown the business something like three or four times. And that's largely due to the expertise from London, of course. And I'm the figurehead for it. So, you know, branding and design is one of those things that's running richly in one's veins, as you well know, Nicholas.
Of course. Well, I think you did indeed start out as a designer, and your daughter is now quite a sought-after designer, I believe, as well. So the apple hasn't fallen far from the tree there. In terms of brand finance, and it's a fascinating field because it has brand in it, but that's not really talking about branding and design, really. This is going into brand valuations. Can you give us a little sort of taste of why brand valuations are important and why companies like Brand Finance actually exist? What is the point? Why do we need to do brand valuations?
Well, just to take a step back, you're quite right. I graduated in graphic design, visual communication at Canterbury in England, and started life as a designer, but then that sort of morphs into more and more branding and marketing. And the thing about brand finance is that it looks at a brand and helps you manage your brand better. You would remember, Nicholas, that there's a magazine in South Africa, which is the weekly business magazine called Financial Mail. and they have a feature on marketing, and 2 weeks ago it was on brand management, and somehow they managed to exclude anything to do with the international standards when it comes to brand management, which means I wrote a letter in high dudgeon to Financial Mail, which they published, and said, come on, guys, ISO, I think it's 10667, which is brand valuation, which is the financial value, and then I think it's something like ISO 20671, which is brand equity and brand strength. And Brand Finance, London-based, 20-odd countries, it's the only consultancy in the world compliant with both those international standards. So when you measure a brand, when you audit a brand, when you track that brand, you need to be compliant with those ISOs, we would argue. And this is where every year now Brand Finance produces probably 50 or 60 rankings. They start from just at the end of January, where we have the Global 500, where the last 3 years it's actually been launched at the World Economic Forum in Davos. A couple of days later, we produce the top banks. And then through the course of the year, we bring out these additional rankings. But you're absolutely right. You know, some people say, oh, Brand Finance is all about the financial value. Not true. We're tracking the brand. We're looking at it. We're comparing it with its competitors. And this is where we spend a lot of time looking at the marketing funnel. And I know different people have different versions of it, but if you roughly say, well, let's talk about awareness, consideration, conversion, loyalty, all those things, and every stage of that funnel can be tracked and measured. And it's fascinating how many brands we find are people are aware of them and they consider them, but they never use them. And that becomes an issue where you want to find out more about it. And you and I, if we had lots of time, would talk about the brands we like, we adopt, we use, might vary depending on what we're doing, where we are, and our stage in life. But also there are brands that we would never use, even though we're very aware of them. So basically, Brand Finance drills down into this, and we have a lot of very clever people. A lot of them are financial people. David Haig, the founder, is a chartered accountant, and most of the guys we deal with, but they have left brain, right brain, and we put it together, and then we can help companies, having done an audit or whatever, develop their brand strategy, perhaps look at the low-hanging fruit, as it were, compare them with their competitive set, and generally get involved in running the business. We also have a tagline, which I think is quite interesting, which is bridging the gap between marketing and finance. And when you think about that, I think a lot of accountants say figures are very hard, and let's face it, they're not. With the way things have gone in the financial world, a lot of figures are not as hard as you think. But when it comes to marketing data, a lot of people think it's soft and fluffy. And again, it is not as soft as people think. And this is where bringing together marketing and bringing together finance, after all, is to look at the major assets of companies and look after them and protect them and grow them. And those major assets are often their brands, but certainly their intangible assets. And that, of course, is the world we play in.
Well, I think since my time at Interbrand Samson, that link between marketing and finance was made very clear to me there. So what I've been doing in my career is trying to exactly bridge that gap between fluffy marketing and finance who hold the purse strings. And with all of this data that we're getting from Google Ads, from various statistics and analytics, marketers have had to, by default, become more accounting focused. Or perhaps in the past we had accounting types becoming marketers because they knew, you know, how business really works. So it's the analytics side and tying it into brand valuations and managing the brand, obviously super important. One brand I'm sure would have benefited from some of your knowledge and experience would have been Twitter, or as it is known now, X. Very strange transition there, very brave. And who knows, X might be, you know, a much more valuable brand one day than Twitter was. And just fascinating, I'm sure we could chat on, bang on about that a little bit in terms of how that rebrand worked. But any
well,
comments on that,
before
Jeremy?
You move on, can I interject? Because yes, because I actually have done several interviews on this, including on CNBC Africa Television. And it's interesting that the research Brand Finance does is the end of the year. In other words, now we're going into August, September, and the research starts. And as I mentioned, the results start coming out from January. But in Twitter's case, in January this year, its brand had been valued at, I think it was roughly 3.5 billion US, whereas January in the previous year, it was valued at 5.8 or so. In other words, it had lost 30% of its brand value January to January. And I think we all agreed that since January this year, it's lost a bit more value before becoming X. And then someone says to me, well, you know, that's terrible. Well, yes, it is terrible to you and I, but I point out that Mr. Elon Musk, who you would know, was born and educated in South Africa. He is the richest man in the world, given SpaceX, Tesla, having started PayPal and a few other things. And he is currently worth something like 240 billion US. In other words, what is going from Twitter to X cost him in brand value? Less than 1% of his assets. And I think you and I, no matter how much we're worth, we wouldn't worry too much about 1% of our assets. So I'm finding I'm one of the few people who defends him to a degree, because being a designer, getting to know Apple back in the mid-80s, Apple is still my favorite brand, but knowing that Mr. Jobs, you know, was not only a very clever man, he was a very complex man, and he had his dark side, as does Mr. Musk. So all I'm saying is, let's watch this space with great interest. You know, for a long time, people forget he comes from a fintech background. That's how he started PayPal and made his first fortune. Now let's see what he does with X, because I find this is going to be, I think, a masterclass case study. But let's give him a few weeks or months. He won't need years. He'll do it very, very fast.
I'm with you on that. I think with him starting to pay contributors on Twitter, he has really opened the floodgates of, you know, possibility on the channel. So, yeah, I think the X brand is going to expand significantly in the future. Jeremy, I'm in Norway, and we have something called the Vinmonopolet, which is a something we don't have in South Africa. It's basically the government monopoly on selling booze. So you can buy beer at the supermarket, but you cannot buy wine. So similar to South Africa in the old days, where the liquor stores had the monopoly on booze. So we don't get to see terribly many great South African wines. I did have a nice bottle of Secateurs the other day, which I found a box wine. But what are you drinking? What are you on at the moment? I know you've got a couple of standards that you've got, but you might have tasted something interesting in the last week or two. What has it been?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Secateurs, because it's Mr. A.A. Bardenhorst, which is in the area north of Stellenbosch. Stellenbosch is the main area, probably. And I can tell you, in August last year, I went down to Stellenbosch and I ran a workshop on branding and marketing for wine. And there must have been about 60 people of the great and the good. So it was very interesting, and I learned a lot as well. But Secateurs is a very good wine. I think up in Scandinavia, KWV are quite active with Rudeberg. I did, again, some consulting about 7 or 8 years ago, and they were telling me that Rudeberg, of course, is Afrikaans, which you know is the old Dutch, as it were, and Rudeberg means red. And the local community in Stellenbosch were very, very upset when they heard that Rudeberg was produced in a white version as well. And they said, how can you take something that's called red and produce it in a white? And, of course, the marketers turned around and said, well, actually, because, you know, the customer wants it. They want the choice of a red and a white, know, like a lot of other famous wines and popular wines. And they asked me what I should do. And I said, well, how serious is it? And they said, well, our managing director in the Pal area, which is adjacent to the Stellenbosch, has actually been getting death threats. It was that serious. And again, they said, what would you do? And I turned to them and said, well, it's quite simple. I produce a rosé, a blush. And, yeah. You know, there were five of us sitting at the table and there was a deathly hush. And I said, well, look, I'm a marketer. I'm looking from the consumer's point of view. They're like a yellowtail, the Australian, yeah. The Americans. They're producing populist wines, as it were. But there's a choice. Red, yeah. White, rosé, sweet, dry, whatever. And let's give the customer what they want. Other than that, you know, and this is where South Africa is spoilt for choice. There are so many wines, and then it comes to the price points. In South Africa, there's a stigma attached to box wine, which is taking some time to overcome. I believe in Germany, something like 80% of all wine drunk is from boxes. And of course, with technology today, box wine can be very, very good. And of course, you can leave it in your fridge and it'll not go off, whereas the bottled wine, if you're not careful, will. But there are so many to choose from. And you and I know that you could go down and get lost in the Cape for 3 or 4 weeks. You can do lots and lots of tasting. Unlike in California, tasters are welcomed. In California, they're more like farms, so they don't want you knocking on the door, as it were. They say, yeah. Go away. Whereas in the Cape, the beautiful scenery, they'll say, come on in. How many wines do you want to taste? And if you're buying wine, probably they won't charge you for the tasting either. But Secateurs is a very good choice. In that area is another group called Molyneux, which you've probably heard of. And Molyneux is run by a couple. She is from California. I think she worked with Mondavi. He is a South African. And they have, over the last 10 years or so, become arguably the top winery, helped by the fact that they have a neighbor who is a millionaire from India, and he's put a lot of money into Molyneux, and the wines they produce are sublime. But I suggest you look them out if you can.
I'll definitely do that. Yeah, I'm missing, I've been trying to find the Hartenberg wines over here, because their Shiraz and their, I think, Cab Sav is just something else. Jeremy, on the wine branding side, fascinating. I'm currently, last year we worked on a promotion with J-Fudo, which is the Japanese Agricultural Food Export Department of the Japanese government. And we were promoting sake in London, of all places. And very interesting, the process of introducing a new type of beverage to a mass market, and sort of some of the challenges we're going through on that. So that's once we win the next pitch, I'll talk to you about that and talk to you about our process. And that's possibly another second wind for you. You can go from wine to sake. Very similar.
Well,
terroir.
I'm not sure I've ever. Yeah. Tasted sake. Oh, really? Yeah. I do have to say that there's a famous sushi place in Cape Town where I've had Japanese whiskey, which was absolutely stunning. Stunning. They said, well, you're in a Japanese restaurant, you can't have Scottish whiskey.
Exactly.
And we were with business people who said, come on, let's enjoy the end of the meal. And the Japanese whiskey was sublime. And I hope you have tried some of that as well.
Yeah, you probably had the Yamazaki, and depending on the budget of your business guest, it would have been the 18-year-old, which is sort of the new Johnny Walker Blue, basically in the whiskey market. So I spent 4 years in Malaysia, and there are a lot of Japanese expats there working for large Japanese companies. So I've drunk my fair portion of. Sake and amazing Japanese whiskies. So yeah, there's such a variety out there. The interesting thing in Norway is that we get to see Hungarian wines and Macedonian wines. I haven't been brave enough yet, but at the end of the month, when the budget runs dry, perhaps we can try a Moldovan red or a Georgian rosé.
But you know, this is interesting because in my days at art school, my final summer vacation before my final year, I did a thesis on wine labels, and that meant going to Bordeaux, of course, and spending 4 or 5 days traveling around there and going to some of the top places and learning how to spit wine, because that's important, sadly, as well. But Monsieur Peter Seychel of Seychel et Fils in Bordeaux, and it's his son now who runs the Bordeaux wine organization. But Peter said, Jeremy, it's quite simple. If you want to know about wine, you've got to drink it. And I would suggest to you, you just drink anything you've never drunk before. You'll always come back to your favorites. And I have to say, I've tried Hungarian wine, and there are some fantastic ones there. I seem to remember being in Finland and having issues there, and I was drinking cloudberry wine, which was absolutely delicious. And I think it was the end of August, early September. So most of my diet was salmon and cloudberries and ice cream, and I could live with that. It was delicious.
Yeah, that's not the worst combination you've got there. Just to close off, Jeremy, I think a very interesting point you've just made is from university, when you chose a project to look at wine labels, to where you are now in your 70s, I believe, focusing and giving, you know, deep insights into the wine industry, packaging, marketing, branding, etc. Wine has spanned your entire life, and possibly, perchance, I'm sure you never thought, you know, looking at wine labels in your early 20s or late teens would have resulted in you being sort of the preeminent oenophile at this stage.
Yes, you just don't know, do you? And during one's formative years, going to college or whatever, I think the first alcoholic beverage I was aware of, other than perhaps beer, and I was very young, is my father used to keep a bottle of Crème de Menthe, which, as you would know, is a beautiful green color. And I'm not sure how involved in Scandinavia the population is in rugby. I know Norway especially has some absolutely brilliant athletes. I love watching the Diamond League. But when it comes to rugby, you know, the Springboks, the South African side, are meant to be the green and gold. And apparently there is now a Springbok drink, which is take a shooter glass and put in half the glass is Crème de Menthe, and the other half should be something like Bailey's Irish Cream, or in South Africa, we have something called Amarula, which is very similar, which is a cream liqueur, and you put the two together. And, you know, this apparently is the ideal way to start watching a game of rugby. Whether you are still awake at the end of it, I don't know. But as you're alluding to, alcohol, obviously, you handle it carefully, as always. But it's very interesting. You mentioned the word terroir earlier on, and you get into vintages and you get into the different cultivars. And I find it's a fascinating world. Perhaps in another world, I would be more involved. But certainly we find as an industry in South Africa, for the most part, they lack marketing skills. They produce very small volumes. They don't produce the scale that is necessary for a brand to become a global brand. And these are the sorts of things you and I could talk well into the night over a bottle or two, because the sector generally lacks scale. And that's why South African wines sometimes are not that well known. But as Jancis Robinson in the Financial Times says, the best value for money, try South African wines.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. Jeremy, thank you so much for spending some time with me. We will definitely have a follow-up after this. Really just fantastic catching up with you, and I hope to hear from you soon.
Nicholas, it's been my pleasure. Thank you, and all best to you.
Come chat with Nicholas. He'll listen to you, then he'll laugh, and then he'll cry with you. It's all in a safe space for you to speak your truth. Oh, come and chat.